Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be a taunt by Senate Republicans to dare the Democrats to go ahead and make their day by changing the Senate rules to end the Republican abuse of the filibuster that just blocked Obama's latest nominee to the third of three vacant seats on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. A veteran Senate senior staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, joins us to discuss whether Harry Reid will make good on his threat to invoke the so-called nuclear option. Then we'll go to Jordan to speak with Nicholas Herrer, a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. We will discuss the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Beirut and the war within the war amongst the Syrian rebels, where the more secular Free Syrian Army has clashed with the Salafist al-Nusra Front, who in turn have clashed with other al-Qaeda-affiliated groups like the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, turning northern Syria into a patchwork of warring fiefdoms. Then, finally, we will speak with Saudi expert Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. We will discuss the role of Saudi and Gulf money pouring into Syria in support of the hardline Salafist groups among the Syrian opposition, and the hollow nature of the Saudi regime's claim that in spite of a powerful secret police and omnipresent religious police that keep such a tight lid on the feudal kingdom, they are unable to stem the flow of private money funding al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Syria. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be back, Ian.
And, Mike, on Monday, the Senate Republicans filibustered Barack Obama's third and final nominee to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So this is following this, of course, was Robert Wilkins. Preceding him was Patricia Millette and Nina Pollard for the three vacant seats on this second most important court in the land. I would suggest that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are basically taunting Harry Reid. Go ahead and make my day. End the filibuster. I mean, what explanation would you have for this brazen blockage?
Well, funny, that's exactly the word I was thinking about, taunting, because no one seemingly has raised any objections to the qualifications or any character flaws in the nominees. What they've done is simply, on a blanket policy basis, denied any of these appointees the right to serve when they're perfectly well qualified. What this is, it amounts to nullification. The discredited theory of John C. Calhoun in the early part of the 19th century that states or a minority of legislators could simply nullify the laws and workings of the federal government if they felt compelled to do so. We fought a civil war over that.
So is this then, if they've thrown down the gauntlet here, does this mean that Harry Reid is going to... I mean, first of all, one of the things that is, I think, a lot of people have been bothered by the fecklessness of the Democrats. And you, of course, in your book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, in terms of the Democrats being useless. One of the things that's been pointed out by a number of people, and George Lakoff at Berkeley has written about this, the idea that the conservatives and the Republicans are so much better than at framing things. Like, for example, the right to life is a much more powerful concept than choice. And in this case, it seems that the Democrats have framed this issue incredibly poorly by describing the return to business as usual in the Senate as the nuclear option. It's not thermonuclear. It's not Armageddon. It's just going back to what you had before the Republicans usurped this position where they've arbitrarily decided that nothing passes the Senate unless it gets 60 votes. So do you see that as a problem, that they're talking about going nuclear when it's actually going back to business as usual?
Right. It could be called simply, we're going back to the constitutional option, because that is the way the Senate has mostly conducted its business throughout history without these kinds of filibusters. The only exceptions have been rather infamous ones in the gag rule over slavery and the filibusters over the civil rights bill. But under normal circumstances, and I'm looking at the Senate's own website on Senate action on cloture motions, which are motions that the majority leader must file to end a filibuster, a number of them are in the single digits in earlier years, or there's one. Sometimes you go through a whole session of Congress with zero filibusters. Then there's a gradual increase in the 1990s, and by the time we roll around to 2010, and that time with the Republicans in the minority in the Senate, it's 137 motions filed. So we have reached a stage where things are very much different from the way they used to be, and this is an extraordinary, as I put it, attempt at nullification.
Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy says that, quoting him, this kind of delay for the sake of delay, this kind of treating this president different from other presidents, that is why there's momentum towards a change. Now, it's pretty clear that this filibuster light, where you don't even have to actually stand on the floor of the Senate and, you know, hold on to your bladder for 13 hours or whatever it is, you don't have to do that anymore, like in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's just a simple procedural motion. So you think Leahy's right, that this has a lot to do with the Republicans' contempt for our first black president?
There could be something to that. I noticed in the follow-up yesterday where Reid simply attacked the Republicans' filibustering, I noted that he didn't even say that he was going to try to change the rules, and Republicans openly taunted him and dared him to try to. Senator Grassley, Republican from Iowa, for one, said, oh, you'll regret this if you do this, because in the future we'd like to put a lot more Scalias and Thomases on the court. Well, that sounds very interesting, except they've got Scalia and Thomas on the court. They were confirmed. Whereas the problem is Obama cannot get his appointees confirmed. So it's kind of an asymmetrical situation. Democrats have not to this extent ever filibustered when they were in the minority, and I doubt they would.
So what are, with the Republicans taunting Harry Reid to invoke the nuclear option, which we've already discussed as a terrible term because it exaggerates the reality of this is simply about going back to business as usual. So what options does he have then, short of ending the filibuster?
Well, I don't think he has any options other than that. This is a Senate rule that, in order to proceed without it, that rule must be changed or circumvented, and that's his only option to do that. It is not, I would hasten to add, some people either mistakenly think or assert that this is somehow part of the Constitution, that this is the way the Senate operates. It is not a part of the Constitution. It is simply a part of Senate rules. At one time, any senator could hold up proceedings for as long as he wanted, and there was no provision for cloture. That ended in 1917 by a change of the rules. In 1975, the currently in force rules called for two-thirds of the senators, 67, to vote to break the filibuster in order to get a vote, and that was changed to 60. So these are simply Senate rules. They can be changed, and they have been changed.
So what's your sense then of what Harry Reid should be doing? They had private meetings on Monday night after this third judge was denied his vote, in the Senate vote of 53-38, which is well below the 60 threshold. Two Republicans joining the Democrats, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. So they apparently, Harry Reid met with his caucus on Monday night, and I believe they're having a lunch on Tuesday as well. What's your sense then of whether Harry Reid is going to step up here and explain to the American people that this is not a part of the Constitution? Isn't that what we really need here? People have to understand this is not the way business is meant to be done by the Founding Fathers. This is basically a Senate rule that's being abused.
Well, they need to engage in a little civics 101 to educate the population of what is and is not true. This has nothing to do with the so-called balance of among executive and legislative branch. It's not the whole sort of
separation of powers. You mean, yeah?
Separation of power, because what that means is that the various branches of government and their powers are balanced off one another by, for instance, a veto or a veto override. It does not mean that one half of the legislative branch simply isn't doing its job. It cannot pass any bills. That's the situation we have now. That has nothing to do with separation of powers or constitutional structures in the government, and people need to make that plain. But I'm afraid that the Democrats, as I've written before, tend to be very timid about their own convictions, and they may be in some ways a little afraid of the Republicans, the way a person might be afraid of his crazy uncle and just wants to kind of mollify him. But now that we've sort of put this whole filibuster issue out on the table and Democrats are complaining about it, it's a very poor threat if you threaten the so-called nuclear option and you're not willing to pull the trigger, and your opponent knows you're not willing to pull the trigger. That's worse than doing nothing.
Well, it seems to be a division within the Democratic caucus between the younger senators and the older senators. The older ones tend to be more leery about changing the rules and more sort of hidebound to Senate traditions, as opposed to the younger senators who are totally frustrated. Is that your reading as well?
Right. Most of the activists, and it may well be a majority of the Democratic caucus, has never been in the Senate except when the Democrats are in the majority. So they have no experience of the Republicans being the majority, or in which they would take advantage themselves, the Democrats, of the filibuster. So they don't really see any advantage to having the filibuster institutionally. And as for the older ones, to some degree, I suppose they're relics of an older Senate where there was more bipartisanship, and two senators across the aisle could get along and so forth, and maybe they really haven't woken up to it's not the way it used to be with Everett Dirksen and Mike Mansfield anymore. And so they're loath to change anything. They're somewhat reluctant to give up what might be a useful tool if Democrats are in the minority. But I tend to think because of psychological and other factors, they wouldn't use it as consistently and with as disciplined a way as the Republicans have in the last 4 or 5 years. Some people defending the filibuster allude to the so-called venerated traditions of the Senate, and that reminds me of when Winston Churchill became first Sea Lord in 1911, and he wanted to reform the Royal Navy, and all these barnacle-encrusted admirals said, you can't reform the Navy. Think of all the traditions. And Churchill simply harumphed and said, the traditions of the Royal Navy are rum, sodomy, and the lash. And I think from that we can also discern quite correctly that the traditions of the Senate in many respects in the last 200 years have been a defense of slavery, Jim Crow, and plutocracy. And they've done that quite effectively and kept the country from progressing in many important respects. And I don't think that's a tradition worth saving.
Well, just in closing, Mike Lofgren, do you think Harry Reid's going to man up?
I cannot make any prediction on that. He's got so many institutional headwinds and crosswinds. No one really runs the Senate, apparently. It's a kind of anarchy where a dedicated minority can get its way. And given what I've seen in policy lunches and things like that, just the way this a group of senators try to work their will, it would be somewhat surprising if they do it, but I think they must.
Well, Mike Lofgren, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Enjoyed being there.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of the various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back and go to Jordan to speak about the war within the war among the Syrian rebels. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Jordan is Nicholas Hara, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Hara.
Thank you for having me.
And there has been, of course, the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Lebanon, in Beirut. Already the Iran's foreign minister has blamed Israel for the attack, but the Syrian government statement blames Saudi Arabia, quoting, "Each of the terrorist attacks that strikes in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq reek of petrodollars." It's pretty clear what they're saying there. So just to start with this, I know we're going to be talking about the Kurdish region and the war within a war that's going on amongst the rebels in northern Syria. This seems to be like the southern front. I mean, this is an extremely complicated mosaic, is it not?
Yes, it is. The attacks today on the Iranian embassy are probably the most blatant statement by forces against the al-Assad regime and its allies, Iran and Hezbollah, that has occurred since the bombings over the summer in the southern Beiruti suburbs of Dahia, a traditional Hezbollah stronghold where many of the party's constituents live. Soon after the attacks, a Sunni Islamist armed opposition group, which claims to be based in Lebanon, the Abdullah Azzam Brigade, stated it had made the attack in order to force Hezbollah to withdraw its fighters from Syria, which have been fighting in support of the al-Assad government. These attacks are again aimed at areas that are considered core support for al-Assad, but how much impact they'll actually have on the fighting on the ground in Syria is questionable. Right now, Hezbollah is reported to be assisting the Syrian army in many key strategic areas of the fighting in Syria, particularly a range of mountains and badlands north and northwest of Damascus called the Jabal Kalamun. And the importance of this area is that it lies on the strategic M5 highway, which connects Damascus, still the capital of the al-Assad government, to its core areas of support in the western governorates of Syria, such as Homs and Latakia and Tartus governorates, where a majority of the Alawite minority support lives for the al-Assad government.
And I was just going to mention, Nicholas Hara, that the Iranian cultural attaché at the embassy in Beirut, Sheikh Ibrahim Ansari, apparently is among the dead. But the point that you're making is, I guess, that the al-Assad regime, with the help of Hezbollah, are rolling back a lot of the gains of the rebels and more isolating the rebel enclave in the Damascus suburbs.
Yes, and in fact, the reason, part of the motivation for this attack on the Jabal Kalamun area has been in order to do exactly that, is to isolate some of the more formed opposition groups, particularly the Islamist Liwa al-Islam and its sometimes allies, the Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, and other groups such as the militant Salafist armed opposition group Ahrar al-Sham, from being able to strike at the M5 highway, which has been a target for the Syrian armed opposition groups since at least last summer. The fighting in the Syrian town of Al-Qusayr, which concluded in June, which was at the time considered the most highly strategic town, which lied near the M5 highway, which ended in a victory for Hezbollah, it's in the Syrian military, and militias drawn up under the National Defense Army, which are local defense units that, if not in support of the al-Assad government, are at least tolerant of the regime and are fearful of the alternative, being armed Islamist opposition groups. And this offensive, which has been described as being in a slow burn, is now seems to be flaring up. And the result has been a large number of refugees from Syria coming into Lebanon. Some recent figures suggest that you have upwards of 18 to 30,000 refugees that have fled into Lebanon from the area of Jabal Kalamun over the weekend. And the fight in that area in many ways is an existential battle for the armed opposition. It has been trying unsuccessfully for over a year now to cut off Damascus from what is considered the core heartland of the Syrian government support. And it blames Hezbollah, which many Hezbollah-controlled areas are contiguous with this region of Syria, for extending the life of the al-Assad government.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications, and we're talking to him from Jordan at the moment. So I wanted to talk to you, of course, about the war within a war, particularly that's gaining momentum in the northern area of Syria, and also the movement on the part of the largest Kurdish group, the Democratic Union Party, the PYD, who have raised the stakes in this very complex and tortured civil war, or civil wars and wars within wars, declaring this area Western Kurdistan. And, of course, this is where Syria produces a lot of its oil. So let's go through these. We've talked about what's happening in the south and the reverses on the battlefield that the Syrian rebels are undergoing. Let's talk now about the war within a war, because I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes piece recently with the American journalist who was captured by some of the al-Nusra Salafist groups, and it was pretty chilling how they moved him around in convoys with two suicide bombers assigned to him with their fingers on the trigger. They ran into a convoy, apparently a Free Syrian Army convoy. There was a shootout amongst them, and this American journalist was expecting to be blown up at any moment. And then you hear recently of a rebel executing and beheading a wounded rebel. We thought it was, in a rebel hospital, but this rebel was apparently reciting a list of, he was delirious and wounded. He was reciting a list of Shia shrines, and they assumed that he was an Alawite and just beheaded him. And then after holding his head aloft and shouting Allah Akbar, somebody noticed the head belonged to a fellow rebel, Sunni rebel leader. So this is all to say, this is a really grim and disgraceful and disgusting situation. And how could it have gotten, how could it have morphed from a popular revolution into this kind of nihilistic bloodletting?
Well, there have been a lot of accusations, and this is a very important point, is how did this conflict move from what at first appeared to be one of the shining moments of the Arab Spring, a push for reform and at least somewhat loosening of what had been fairly closed Syrian society, at least socially and politically, and into this harsh sectarian war. And there's a lot of evidence that both sides are to blame. We have evidence from activists on the ground. We have evidence from people who have been covering the conflict since the very beginning that there had been the attempts by the al-Assad government through its Mukhabarat, its secret police, and through gains that were raised, criminal gains such as the Shabiha, which were predominantly Alawite and sectarian orientation, but included others, including Christians and Sunnis, and in some areas were there other minorities such as the Druze, which are a religious minority, to attack protesters and to try to stir up sectarian sentiment and to point to graffiti on the walls that declared that the Christians would go to Beirut and the Alawites would go to the grave. On the other hand, there had been evidence from research that had been done prior to the Syrian civil war and also as the conflict went on that there had been a latent angry presence within certain Sunni movements within Syria against not only the al-Assad government but against Alawites and other minorities in general, and that as the conflict wore on and as soldiers and police fired on peaceful demonstrations, and as killings occurred, and as tension started and flared up on village-to-village level in many areas of the country, that the conflict had a logic of its own, and that as foreign fighters became involved through organizations such as Jabhat al-Nusra, now most strongly with the Islamic State of Iraq and in the Levant, the fighting has gone so far, the militarization of sectarian and ethnic minority communities such as Christians, such as Alawites, which many of whom are being raised in local defense units called the Popular Committees, which are armed and funded by the Syrian government and which have received training from the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and from Hezbollah and from the Syrian military, that the fighting has become so existential that neither side, whether it's the Al-Assad government, whether it's regime-tolerant communities, maybe not they may like Bashar al-Assad, but they don't trust the armed opposition. And the fact that the general weakness of Free Syrian Army, you know, the Western backed or the Western hoped for successor military and security force in Syria, the Free Syrian Army, organized under the Supreme Military Council, these armed opposition groups' general weakness vis-a-vis the more hardline Islamist groups has made this really an existential struggle. Neither side, the Bashar al-Assad government or the most powerful armed opposition groups, which happens to be ideologically Islamist, many of them militant Salafists, have any reason to stop the fighting, because neither side at this point can really hope for much out of a transition.
So, in my understanding, Nicholas Herrera, is that there was an important rebel commander that was killed in a Syrian airstrike. He was with the more secular forces, but apparently he also came under criticism from his own ranks because he was trying to negotiate and navigate with the Islamists. And that sounds, a really grim activity, isn't it? I mean, it seems like the Salafist groups, the concept of negotiation and compromise is completely foreign, right? They are, for all intents and purposes, fanatics.
Particularly with groups such as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Lebanon, and even against other hardline Islamist groups, late April and May, there was several reports of conflict between the Islamic State of Iraq and the Lebanon in Jabhat al-Nusra, its nominal ally, and there had been an attempt on the life of Jabhat al-Nusra's commander, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, by the Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon, to the point where the spiritual head of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, had to intervene and had to basically tell them, tell the Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon recently, you focus on Iraq, Jabhat al-Nusra focuses on Syria. And this tension between Islamist groups, not just the ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon, and Jabhat al-Nusra, but also other militant Salafist groups, such as Ahrar al-Sham, the Free Ones of Syria, which is another extremely powerful national militant Salafist armed opposition organization, which cooperates with Jabhat al-Nusra. Now there are serious reports that those two groups are cooperating against ISIS and other Islamist armed groups. Their weakness within each other, within themselves, weakens their front against the government, the military of Bashar al-Assad. And the Syrian military, while it's been making recent gains, it in and of itself is not powerful enough yet to win on every front. A lot of these gains against the rebels have occurred because of weakness within the rebels' unity. And the fighter, the commander you were talking about earlier, Abdul Qadir al-Salah, who is the leader of Liwa al-Tawhid in the area of Aleppo, was somewhat of a folk hero. While there was criticism of him of at times being almost too conciliatory towards groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, all reports indicate that he represented a very powerful strain of ideological and military support amongst the armed opposition communities. That is, many areas of Syria, such as those areas in Aleppo and around Aleppo, which are predominantly Sunni, tend to have a local social cultural bent towards Sunni Islamism. And now, most often the case, it's not all the way towards hardline Salafism, but it is there. It is more conservative form of Sunni Islam. And long-running problems with the Al-Assad government flared up over the course of the conflict. And that's what makes Abdul Qadir al-Salah's death particularly hard hitting for the rebel movement, is that Aleppo is, in many ways, its most important front, with the Kurds consolidating the strength in the northeast, with the area in the far eastern city of Deir ez-Zor being a confusing and oftentimes conflicting mix of patchwork government control, local tribal militias, al-Qaeda affiliate groups such as ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, fighting it out for control of oil and for control to access to border points. And with the southern front in the area of Daraa being weakened and predominantly under the command of the FSA, the front of Aleppo is very important. And Abdul Qadir al-Salah represented perhaps the most important, or certainly one of the most important people and figures that could hopefully, from the perspective of the rebels, bridge some sort of consensus to at least share their resources, coordinate their movements, and try to push back the Al-Assad government's recent offensive. And now there's going to be less coordination, there's going to be less alliance building, and you'll probably see most of these armed opposition groups seeking to consolidate their power wherever they happen to be powerful. And we could be seeing the start of the separation of areas of Syria that are already under armed opposition control into small fiefdoms.
So just in the last minute or so then, Nicholas Herrer, my understanding is that the Assad regime has actually gone after the more secular groups, the more Free Syrian Army groups with greater firepower, and haven't pursued the Salafist groups quite as zealously, because the Salafists, Saudi-backed, Qatari-backed, and frankly, I find it very hard to understand how Saudi Arabia, that is a very tightly run country with a very strong secret police and religious police as well, why they continually say, well, I'm sorry, we can't stop the flow of money. This is just private money. This is not official state money. It seems very inconsistent that the state, such a tightly run state, can't control the outflow of money. But that aside, it seems that the whole idea of these Salafist groups and their backing from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf has played right into Assad's hands.
Yes, it has. And it's also, and that's an important point to raise, because one of the most powerful armed opposition groups in Damascus, the capital, Liwa al-Islam, which is the focus of the current Syrian military and Hezbollah offensive in that area, the Jabal al-Mun, north of Damascus, has reports of having strong ties with Saudi intelligence. And some estimate that it's received millions of dollars in financial assistance from the Saudi government and Saudi intelligence. And this axis, the Syrian government under Bashar al-Assad and Hezbollah under Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, consistently made this point throughout the conflict. They've created a narrative of resistance. And their narrative of resistance, which before had been part of an axis of resistance with Iran and at one point Hamas and other concerned parties, had always been aimed towards Israel, towards confronting Israel, towards hope winning one day, winning back Jerusalem and all the way into Palestine and forcing back the Israeli foe, has now shifted to a new narrative of resistance. And this narrative of resistance isn't necessarily new. Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, during what some could argue credibly was an actual civil war from 1976 to 1982, where the militant Salafist Fighting Vanguard group actively waged attacks against the Syrian military, which is military, and also members of the Ba'ath Party that it perceived to be part of a corrupt Alawite-dominated government, the precursor in many ways to Arab fighters that would go and join Osama bin Laden's movement in Afghanistan, and then the precursor to all these hardcore militant Salafist movements that we see now today in Syria as history turns again. This narrative of resistance that's been cultivated by Bashar al-Assad, a reinvention of his father's narrative of resistance, which has been added to Hezbollah's narrative of resistance, now focuses on these militant Salafist groups and aligns them as the main dagger being wielded by a conspiracy of Gulf Arab, Sunni Gulf Arab monarchy states, the United States and the West writ large, and Israel, in order to defeat the axis of resistance and to weaken or destroy their ability to confront Israel and to confront what they implied, the government of Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah, and the Islamic Republic of Iran, as imperialism. And this is an important point because going along with sectarian community fears, the fears of communities such as Christians, the fears of some Sunnis who do not trust the more hardline elements in the armed opposition, other communities such as the Druze and the Alawites, the minority Alawite community, which the Al-Assad regime draws Tartar core support. These fears very neatly neatly go along with this renewed sense and this renewed message of resistance narrative against a foreign conspiracy wielding militant jihadism to destroy what had been a secular Syrian regime.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Nicholas Harrow. We haven't even got to the even further complication of what's happening in the Kurdish area of Syria, which is similar to what happened in Iraq 10 years ago, where the Kurds sense an opportunity to right old wrongs and reverse the Arabization and, of course, seize the oil reserves. This has even prompted the Barzani, the head of the Kurdish autonomous area of northern Iraq, to accuse the Syrian Kurdish group PYD of being in league with Assad to wreck a golden opportunity for Kurdish unity in Syria. So that is a further complication we don't have time to discuss, but I really appreciate you joining us here today from Jordan, Nicholas Herra.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications, and he joined us from Jordan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the hollow nature of the Saudi regime's claim that it can't stop the flow of private money to fund al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as the political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Thank you for having me.
And we were just speaking then with Nicholas Herra in Jordan, who's an analyst on the war within the war amongst the Salafist opposition and versus the Free Syrian Army and the extent to which Syria is becoming a patchwork of warring fiefdoms. But the issue of Saudi and Gulf money pouring into Syria came up, and I'm wondering if you have an answer, Toby, to the obvious question here, which is that the Saudi regime claims that in spite of its powerful secret police and omnipresent religious beliefs that keep such a tight lid on the feudal kingdom, they are unable to stem the flow of private money funding these al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Syria. Does that strike you as a bit of a paradox, that this is a pretty tightly run ship that the royal family run in Saudi Arabia, and yet they say they can't stop all this private money? It's all unofficial. It's all charity.
I think the Saudis protest too much. It's not at all clear to me that they have an interest in stemming the flow of private money on the one hand. And we can think about this historically as well. the Saudis have a long history of complicity in providing material support for insurgent networks, particularly political Islamist networks, both in Central Asia as well as in Iraq during the post-2003 period, and especially in the period between 2004 and 2007, when Saudi money and Saudi citizens funneled into Iraq to fight both the occupation and against Iraqi Shia. While the Saudi government, particularly in that latter conflict, was on the record as being opposed to the insurgency, nevertheless didn't do very much to check either the ambition of the ideologues of a counterinsurgency campaign or of keeping people from traveling. So, and we know that with respect to Syria and what's happening there, that the Saudis have been much more outspoken and clear in their support for the fall of Assad, as well as the provision of weapons and other kinds of material support. So it's not at all clear to me that the Saudis are not interested in having private cash move from the kingdom into Syria. So I don't know that there are any effective efforts or any desire on the part of the state to keep it from happening.
So, Toby Jones, if that's the case, if this is a sort of unofficial official policy, what are the Saudis' aims? Surely did they, I mean, first of all, within their own kingdom, Al-Qaeda was a wake-up, apparently, particularly when bin Laden threw his passport, I think, at the king and stormed off. And then after 9/11, et cetera, the Saudis did seem to change their support for the Taliban, reversed, and they have, you know, had these re-education programs for Al-Qaeda. They seem to, at least on the surface, say that bin Laden's dead now, but Al-Qaeda is still enemy number one. And I just don't understand how you could, on the one hand, say you're at war with Al-Qaeda, at the same time provide funds to Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. So explain if you can.
Yeah, let's keep in mind that the Saudis are at war with Al-Qaeda at home. But this doesn't mean that they don't support or don't see as useful the effort that Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups elsewhere, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Central Asia, whether it's in Africa, or whether it's in Syria. This is not to say that the Saudis don't have dual, seemingly to us, paradoxical views on what kind of role these networks can play. The Saudis have a complicated view of regional and global geopolitics. Their principal political anxiety, the things that they worry about the most, are, of course, what happens inside the kingdom. So we can view the role of Al-Qaeda as threatening there, but from the Saudi perspective, it's not entirely unuseful to have potentially threatening networks active abroad, bogged down abroad, and engaged on foreign battlefields. The problem for the Saudis is what happens after Syria's war is over, and how do they keep those networks from coming back home? I think that's something the Saudis are willing to risk in the long term for pursuing the short-term gain of toppling Assad's regime. And I think their broad strategic objective is to peel Syria away from the Iranian sphere of influence. And they're willing to play with fire to get there.
So in other words, they're not necessarily in sync with the sort of nihilistic aims of these various groups, which, you know, if the worst comes to the worst, we'll have a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean. They don't necessarily want that outcome, but that at this point they're focused on bringing down the Assads. How do you then explain, though, this peculiar tacit alliance that the Saudis appear to have with the Israelis? It's interesting that Iran has blamed Israel for the attack or the bombing at the Iranian embassy in Beirut, and Syria's official spokespeople are saying they're blaming, I'll just quote what they said, each of the terrorist attacks that strike in Lebanon, Syria and Iraq, in Lebanon, Syria and Iraq, reek of petrodollars. So it's pretty clear what they're saying there. But it does seem in many ways that Saudi Arabia and Israel are on the same page in their support for the military takeover in Egypt. And I was assuming in many ways that they had similar aims in Syria. But surely the Israelis don't want Al-Qaeda groups running Syria, do they? So what is the extent and nature of this peculiar alliance, if indeed it is an alliance, between Saudi Arabia and Israel?
Well, I think it's a de facto alliance. I don't think there's any kind of formal recognition that this is the case. But certainly, I think you're absolutely right that the Israelis and the Saudis share two views in common. The general view is that the long history of what they believe was a period of autocratic stability is threatening to fall, and that this is a potentially existential crisis in the region, that once democracy potentially takes hold across the Arab world, that there are all kinds of unpredictable political possibilities. For the Israelis, it could mean the passing of an era of the absence of accountability on Palestine and other regional issues. And for the Saudis, it could potentially mean the collapse of autocracy at home, that democratic empowerment across the region could spill over into the kingdom and potentially awaken, if you will, aspirations among Saudi citizens that they want a bigger say in government. So that's one thing that they share in common, that the Arab uprisings seemed to threaten a couple of years ago, is the old autocratic order and their desire to maintain it. And the other thing that they share is they share, of course, a deep suspicion and fear of Iran. And that fear or the suspicion works on two levels. From the perspective of the Saudis, it's an anxiety about regional hegemony and the competition between those two countries historically, at least since the late 1970s, early 1980s. And Saudi Arabia is a desire to be the most powerful player in the region, but especially to be able to check Iranian ambition in the Persian Gulf. For the Israelis, of course, it's framed more in the language of security, national security. Of course, Iran has done its part in inflaming anxiety in Israel. And, of course, there's all sorts of uncertainty about Iran's objectives with respect to a nuclear program, even though it doesn't have a weapons program right now. But there's also a kind of utility for both the Saudis and the Israelis that they share in common, and that Iran, in keeping it as a focal point for crisis in the region, that is to say, it's not something that they necessarily want to resolve in an amicable way, because by keeping Iran a target both for each other and for both of their biggest ally and patron outside the region, the United States, it forecloses the possibility of having more complicated political discussions at home. Saudis don't want to talk about reform. They don't want to talk about human rights. They don't want to deal with their Shia community. And if they can point to Iran as a threat on the immediate horizon, they don't have to. They can mobilize their citizens against it. Similarly, in Israel, if Iran is seen as an existential threat, they don't have to talk about Palestine or the peace process.
So what do you think went on with the recent visit of Secretary of State John Kerry to Saudi Arabia? There was reports that the Saudis were feeling peeved at the U.S.'s overtures to Iran and the apparent progress being made in the P5+1 talks, which ended without an agreement, but they are resuming, and presumably an agreement is close. Is there a possibility of a big strategic shift underway, and could the Saudis be left out in the cold?
I don't think the possibility exists in the short or medium term. I wouldn't put a date on such a thing happening. I mean, from my perspective, I think it's very promising and necessary that the Americans and the Iranians, as well as whatever European partners they have, arrive at some sort of agreement that opens the door, creates the conditions for possible other more meaningful strategic and political discussions that would include actors from within the region. But I think we should take the P5+1 discussions and negotiations as relevant only to Iran's nuclear energy program and not as something more important. But from the perspective of the Saudis, and especially their overreaction and the kind of fit that they've thrown over the last 2 weeks or so, we can understand what a possible strategic breakthrough might mean for them, and it is something that they desperately don't want to see. I think in the end, that if the United States, its partners, and Iran are able to come to some sort of short-term rapprochement or reconciliation, the Saudis will live with it, but they don't like it.
But my understanding is that there's a big change underway in the international oil markets that the Saudis dominate, that the U.S., because of this fracking that's going on, is becoming more and more energy self-sufficient. Apparently, the U.S. will surpass Russia as the biggest producer of natural gas, if they haven't already done that, but it's going to happen pretty soon, apparently. And my understanding is that the Saudis basically, if the U.S. depended on the Gulf oil, which we've often heard is a problem and has led to these wars, that frankly the U.S. have lost the Iraq war and are in the process of losing the Afghan war, unless somebody can tell me otherwise. I don't see any victory there. There was a previous Gulf War, of course, against Saddam Hussein as well. So there's been a general mantra in this country about freeing ourselves from foreign oil. Apparently that is underway. Wouldn't this mean that the Saudis would then be turning to China, and therefore China would become a more important ally, if you will, than the United States?
Well, it's an incredibly complicated question on multiple levels. I mean, on the one hand, you're right. There is no global oil scarcity, or at least we're rapidly closing in on a moment where the global oil market is not quite what the Saudis would like for it to be. And whether that's a consequence of American shale gas or whether it's a consequence of the tar sands or other possible available resources coming on into production, it's hard to say where it's all going to happen. But projections are that the United States is going to be the world's largest producer of energy within a decade or shorter. So certainly the Saudis are worried about that, but the Saudis are not going to be marginalized entirely. And this has to do with lots of complexities of the global oil market, how oil is sold globally, who the consumers are, all kinds of other issues that are to be determined and that are not resolved in the current moment. For example, even if the United States becomes a larger exporter or producer of energy, if it's natural gas energy, that doesn't necessarily translate to massive transportation. For example, is there going to be a corresponding shift in the way automobiles are fueled or in the way airplanes are fueled? I don't see that in the short term, so the Saudis are still going to remain relevant as oil producers. The bigger question, though, is about how Saudi Arabia will respond to a world in which energy resources are more balanced and more broadly available. And your question, will they turn to China? Will they turn elsewhere? Well, on the one hand, most of their oil is already sold in East Asia, so not much is going to change with that respect. On the security front, particularly the issue of protection and where their strategic alliances will be, I suppose it's possible that the Saudis could pursue a more complex arrangement of security relationships, including bringing the Chinese or the Russians in or others. But neither of those two places, as far as I understand, are necessarily interested in committing their material or military resources to the Persian Gulf. They're quite happy to have the Americans there, providing whatever stability the Americans allegedly provide, because it serves their interests as well. And I also don't think that the Chinese, for example, have a blue water navy that's necessarily capable of being a global force like the American Navy is.
Well, Toby Jones, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Sure, Ian. Good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was